Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the trifecta of scandal, the IRS, Benghazi, and the AP, that is supposed to be crippling the White House. For some context, we turn to award-winning investigative journalist Mark Feldstein, the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture, and discuss the doctored White House emails that were leaked to the Weekly Standard and ABC News to breathe new life into the so-called Benghazi scandal, and whether there is a there, and what Obama should do to put these manufactured scandals to rest. Then, with recent revelations that Air Force personnel in charge of launching nuclear missiles have been relieved from their posts due to poor morale, we look into the Dr. Strangelovian world of why those who babysit these Cold War relics under the prairies of North Dakota are disciplined because they recognize the futility of what they are doing, while those who were prepared to destroy the world during the Cold War were given promotions. Rudolf Herzog, the author of A Short History of Nuclear Folly, Mad Scientists, Dithering Nazis, Lost Nukes, and Catastrophic Cover-Ups, joins us to discuss the dark comedy of the nuclear age that still lives on. And joining us now is Mark Feldstein. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Great to be here, Ian.
And your old network there that you work for, ABC News, of course, got a lot of praise for, I think it was a week ago Friday, for breathing new life into this Benghazi story that's been largely carried by Fox News ever since 9/11 of last year, when four Americans were killed in Benghazi. They have been beating the drum on it as though there was a there. And then there were some hearings that Darrell Issa put on the House Oversight Committee. And then, of course, ABC News, Jonathan Carr came up with this these White House memos that seemed to indicate that the White House massaged the talking points for Susan Rice, which had been a charge the Republicans had been leveling all along. And it turned out that what Jonathan Carl of ABC News were given were doctored emails. So where do, I mean, is there a mea culpa coming from ABC and from the Weekly Standard?
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath, certainly not from the Weekly Standard, which has long been a kind of conservative organ, partisan broadsheet or magazine for the right. With ABC, it usually tries to hew toward a more mainstream audience, and if as it appears, and all the facts aren't completely in, but it does look like Jonathan Carl was had by his source, and anytime you're dealing with anonymous sources, the public always has to scratch their head and wonder, because they have to take the reporter's word on faith, and you have to depend on the credibility of the reporter to rely on good sources, not bad sources. And any reporter worth his or her salt would know that if the source was a partisan operative, like a Republican on the Hill, that you would have to take what they say with a grain of salt. And to claim you have obtained emails when, in fact, somebody has only told you what they claim they saw is, a real violation, a real breach of traditional journalistic ethics. And so if that can be proved, then I think Carl is in hot water, and ABC News will have to give an apology.
Well, CNN's Jake Tapper, of course, had totally different emails that he got from the White House, and apparently they'd given them to the Congress months ago, when the Congress was beating the drum over Benghazi and making charges of cover-up. The White House just you know, in the interest of transparency, gave them this stuff. So it looks as if somebody in that chain from the White House back to the Weekly Standard and ABC News doctored these and you know, made them far more incriminating than they were.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, when I was a reporter at CNN during the Clinton years, the Republicans on the Hill were played fast and loose with the facts as they attempted to dig up dirt on the Clinton White House. And we're really seeing the same thing going on now with the Obama White House. And that's why it's so important that the journalists be on guard for being spun by their sources and they not overplay information that's given to them anonymously by a partisan source. Now, you know, in fairness, we should say we can't be certain that the White House released all the emails there are. It's conceivable that they, too, are holding something back. But they released, I think, more than 100 of them, whereas what the ABC News got was really a very truncated excerpt and secondhand at that. So, you know, if I had to bet, I'd put my money now on what CNN's reporting rather than on ABC. And if indeed the CNN story can be upheld when all the facts are out, there's tremendous egg on the face of ABC News in general and on Tapper in particular, rather Jonathan Carl in particular.
Well, I recall, Mark Feldstein, that during the Clinton scandals, which, after all, or most that Whitewater part of it was completely made up. The Clintons yep. actually lost money in the, yep. in a bad real estate deal, but it went on for years and years and got an enormous amount of ink and airtime. And it was only later when Clinton handed them the gift of Monica Lewinsky that they were able to nail him for anything that even looked like scandal. And when he first came into office, his first nominee for Attorney General was his friend Webster Hubbell, who the Republicans went after with a vengeance. Eventually, Webb Hubbell went to jail, and the jail conversations with him and his wife, which of course are often routinely recorded in jails, those got Dan Burton, the head of a Republican Congressional Committee, got hold of them, and they doctored the tapes and the transcripts of those conversations that Webb Hubbell had with his wife to make it look as if Webb Hubbell was getting money from some sleazy Indonesian millionaire to fund Clinton. And he said things like, in reality, to his wife, and they transcribed that as Riyadi, which was the name of the Indonesian guy. This is really outrageous. But guess who did that doctoring? And Dan Burton was, who was a highly partisan guy, was forced to fire this guy, none other than David Bossie, who ends up being the guy that who is the Citizens United guy, the very guy whose case was brought to the Supreme Court and has changed the entire nature of our politics.
Well, that's right, and you know, I know David Bossie and dealt with him when I was a reporter, and he was a common source for reporters. But every decent reporter knew you had to watch very carefully what you got from him, just as you did with the other side, because there was such a clear partisan agenda. In fact, he told one of my sources that I'm going to bring Bill Clinton down, even if I have to take the Republican Party with me. And in a sense, he succeeded. You know, the same forces are at play now. You know, you have a third of the congressional machinery now in the House devoted to trying to delegitimize the Obama White House by digging up dirt on what's going on there. And, you know, these three so-called scandals, trifecta appearing all in the same week, that so much is being made of in Washington, you know, with comparisons to Richard Nixon, are really kind of historical blasphemy. To equate that with, you know, these sort of trumped up pseudo scandals with anything that occurred during Watergate, which was so much more criminal and ultimately creating a constitutional crisis, is to really just disregard the historical reality.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Feldstein. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. Now, Mark, it seems that particularly with Fox News and with Limbaugh and others, it's just a reflexive alternative reality that they have, that they actually create an alternative reality. This week, the president hosted the prime minister of Turkey at the White House, and in the midst of a rainstorm, Obama asked the Marines to bring out some umbrellas so that the prime minister wouldn't get soaked, and Obama made a joke, you know, I can change my suit, but I don't think he can, you know, and he was quite gracious about it. If you would have seen the reporting on Fox, it was unbelievable. I mean, they say, here he is, you know, they're letting the Marine get wet and he's, you know, he's dry and this is how he treats our fighting men. You know, they give him cover, but he doesn't give them cover. I mean, it's outrageous what they say. And is that, just since you've studied this culture of scandal, am I seeing something new here in the level of toxicity?
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you go back to the earliest days of the Republic, the newspapers that Jefferson and Hamilton ran were pretty nasty to each other. So in that sense, no, it's existed since the beginning of the Republic. But I do think, you know, in the last generation, we have seen it's moved in cycles, and it's moved from more deferential and objective journalism to more partisan journalism on both sides, but, you know, particularly on the right. And so you really do have Fox News and a number of the Weekly Standard and a number of other magazines and websites and so forth that are, you know, extraordinarily partisan, and their invective is strong. And their agenda is clear. You have some on the left, but they don't seem to be able to compete at either the reach or the decibel level on the right.
Well, Mark, I get hundreds of emails every day from right-wing groups offering up guests to talk to. And the talking points, while there's a sort of uniformity to them, sometimes they are so absurd, it's just, you know, laughable. And a lot of the talking points that are now circulating on the right, and there's an element of frenzy to it, they're talking now about that because of this trumped up IRS scandal, they're now saying that Obama stole the 2012 elections, when in fact, you know, the real issue with the IRS is that these 501c4s, these so-called social welfare tax-exempt vehicles that have been used for flagrant political purposes, 90% of which have been done by the Republicans and by the Tea Party. And there's the very good analysis of that in Sunday's New York Times on the front page about what really happened and how the IRS is trying to deal with this absolute blizzard of applications for tax exemption in this flagrantly political way that they use these, social welfare tax exemptions. It's pretty astounding the kind of thinking that goes on, and you realize that there's an awful lot of people in this country that have the most bizarre beliefs about who this man in the White House is, and nothing is going to change them, and they cling to anything that might reinforce these beliefs. But what do you think Obama can do about this? Because it seems to me that he's really mishandled the IRS thing. I thought that could have been a great opportunity for him to talk about Citizens United and the absolute outrageous nature and the consequences of that ruling, and how billions are flowing into our political process in the name of charity, in effect, and that's completely wrong.
Well, it's tough. You know, the old saying is it's tough to fight. You know, you never win in a fight with the people who buy ink by the barrel, and that was kind of in the old days of print. You know, Franklin Roosevelt had the same problem with a right-wing press, William Randolph Hearst, and
Colonel McCormick,
Begler and McCormick, and that ilk. So, you know, it's tough because, you know, on the one hand, you know, if you come out swinging, you almost give more credence to it. On the other hand, if you lay back, it doesn't go away. I'm not sure there is any easy and obvious solution. You know, but I certainly agree that, you know, the IRS issue not only stemmed from Citizens United, which ironically, as you pointed out, was brought to us by the same folks who gave us Clinton impeachment, that, you know, in previous administrations, there have been similar issues raised about going after progressive groups, whether gay or, you know, gay rights groups or whatever. So it's not that this is completely new. Not to defend what seems to have happened in Cincinnati, that was pretty, you know, indefensible if they were singling out Patriot or Tea Party folks and not doing the same for folks on the left. But, you know, to compare it with Nixon when he was, you know, ordering tax audits of liberal Democrats and using it as a, you know, a form of punishment, it's, you know, there's nothing to suggest that. Here, you know, all that's known to date is that, you know, sort of low-level bureaucrats kind of maybe, you know, maybe ideological driven or maybe just sort of incompetent, not knowing how to do it.
Well, but being this is a new condition, though. That's what the Sunday's New York Times front page story makes it clear.
Right.
The blizzard of applications is overwhelming, and I'm not suggesting that Obama, stooped to the level of his accusers, but rather change the subject and talk about something that's really important, that's at the heart of the issue, as opposed to get sucked into it. To some extent, he did get sucked into their narrative by doing that mea culpa and by saying, oh, this is outrageous, et cetera. That's not going to satisfy the Republicans.
Well, nothing will. I mean, that's the problem with appeasement, if you will, is, you know, you give an inch and then they want a foot, and you give a foot and then they want a yard. So I think you're right. Just as a matter of optics, you know, and tactics, that's right. And part of his job, you know, in the bully pulpit is to explain the Citizens United case, which the public is overwhelmingly against. The public doesn't support, special interest money controlling campaigns and elections. And the voters are smart enough to see through that. Let's hope they get around to it, because right now the dialogue and the discourse in Washington is so debased, it's almost like Alice in Wonderland. You would think that something real had just occurred in this past week, rather than the kind of coincidental confluence of several different really unrelated non-scandals.
Well, just in closing, Mark Feldstein, it does seem, though, that in second terms, presidents get beset by things that go wrong. And obviously, there's no comparison between what's happening now with the White House and Watergate and Iran-Contra. But Watergate happened in Nixon's second term, Iran-Contra and Reagan's second term. Both were, you know, popular presidents with tremendous poll numbers, I guess.
Right.
And they both suffered serious hits, and one of them, of course, was almost impeached and had to resign. So just in closing, give us some context about the second term kind of curse, if you will, and what Obama can do to endure here and get something done with a completely destructive Congress that seems to really be dedicated to doing nothing in order not to give him any victories and therefore ultimately punish the American people.
Well, I think it's tough for him. I'm not sure I accept the second-term curse notion. I mean, with both Iran-Contra and Watergate, those are very real scandals, constitutional crises even, that occurred in the first term and weren't uncovered until the second. With Obama, there really is no such, you know, misconduct. What he does have that those other two presidents didn't face is a House of Congress so implacably devoted to his destruction in the House with, you know, Republican majority, that it's just going to be very difficult for him to, and it always was before these scandals, to achieve anything. And in a way, these scandals are really not the cause, but the effect of the Republican determination to bring him down. And if it wasn't this, it would be something else. There was a time when it looked like perhaps he could get some stuff through where their interests overlapped, immigration, for example, because some of the more moderate elements of the Republican Party, you know, are hoping not to write off the Hispanic vote in perpetuity. But now it looks like, you know, even some of this commonsensical legislation where their interests overlap may be difficult to get through. And if the Republicans want to be a party of nihilism, where they just say no to everything, no matter what, it really is, under our system, only so much a president can do. He can try to go over their heads to the people. He can hope for judicial vacancies to fill. He can try to do better in the midterms, although these pseudo-scandals may cost him in 2014. But even a president of the United States has limited powers, let's hope he is back on his game. If anything's going to get through of a positive nature in the next 3 years.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Mark Feldstein.
A pleasure, as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how Air Force personnel, with their fingers on the nuclear triggers, have been relieved because of poor morale.
The Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia, and whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rudolf Herzog, who is the author of Dead Funny, Telling Jokes in Hitler's Germany. His documentary on humor in the Third Reich, Laughing with Hitler, scored top audience ratings in Germany and was also broadcast on the BBC. His other film projects include the hit reality crime series The Heist and The Agent, which investigates the Stasi's top nuclear spy and a double agent for the CIA. He is the son of the celebrated filmmaker Werner Herzog, and his latest book just out is A Short History of Nuclear Folly, Mad Scientists, Dithering Nazis, Lost Nukes, and Catastrophic Cover-Ups. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rudolf Herzog.
Hi there.
And this subject of nuclear absurdity has come back into the news, where we just learned last week that the Air Force had to strip 17 Air Force officers of the power to launch nuclear missiles from the 91st Missile Wing at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. And the curious and sort of strange Lovian nature of this is that because these officers who were stuck in these capsules under the prairies of North Dakota for hours on end with nothing to do, their morale suffers because they know the futility of what they're doing because the Cold War is over, yet they're babysitting these monstrous missiles that could wipe out whole cities. And the Air Force is concerned that during the Cold War, the morale was high because these guys were prepared to end the world. But now that they're not prepared to end the world, that's a bad thing.
I mean, that is rather strange, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's absurd. It is an absurdity. I don't know to what kind of errors that led, but nowadays, of course, it's like, you know, accidentally launching one of those weapons or something like that. I mean, that there's sort of permissive action links, there's sort of codes that protect them. But that was a whole lot different during the Cold War, especially the early phase. I mean, you even had sort of human error, like in the Carolinas, they flew over the house of a train conductor and someone pulled a wrong lever, and a Nagasaki-type nuclear bomb just dropped into the man's yard from the plane. And the conventional explosive that was inside it even detonated. There's still a crater there today. I mean, these kind of things happen. They lost about 40 nuclear bombs in the Cold War alone. So a lot of human error happens, low morale happens. You got to reckon with that when humans are involved. Unfortunately, that's a reality, and that can be very hazardous if you look at a technology like that. I mean, it's a sort of doomsday weapon. So yes, it's worrying to some degree.
Well, but it's bad enough to have a nuclear war on purpose, but to have one by accident is pretty unacceptable.
Well, it almost happened, at least in one documented case, in near Goldsboro in the Carolinas. A bomb went down, and one of the hydrogen bombs, and I talk about this in my book, I mean, ended up in a hanging off a parachute from a tree. And when they examined it, of all the kind of security, the triggers, all of them had been tripped except one. So even that it was hanging on a parachute wasn't a really good sign, because these bombs were designed to explode in the air. That's why the parachute was part of the triggering sequence, and that had opened. So that wasn't really great either. So yes, we've at least in one documented case, we've been very, very close to an accidental detonation. And God knows, you know, what happened in the Soviet Union or China or other places. And it just doesn't make me feel particularly well about, you know, the handling of nuclear weapons in places like Pakistan and North Korea. You must realize it's not over. I mean, it's just changed. The Cold War's disappeared, but, you know, new threats have come up, and it could likely become very messy in the future. So I'm afraid the Cold War may be over, but not the nuclear threat as such.
Well, in terms of just this missile wing at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, back in 2007, airmen at Minot accidentally loaded a B-52 with six nuclear weapons, and it flew all the way to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. And then nuclear weapons parts were mistakenly shipped to Taiwan in error in 2008. And it wasn't until 18 months later, after the fuses for the nuclear warheads were shipped, that they even learned about it. And these are the same fuses you're talking about.
I laugh about this. I mean, it's awful, really. But, I mean, in the Cold War, a lot, you know, things happened that were, in a way, a lot worse. I mean, they if you talk about Dakota, I mean, they detonated nuclear bombs there underground on purpose for fracking, I mean, to extract shale gas. That was one of Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb's plans. He kind of thought of like peaceful uses of the nuclear bomb. And they extracted gas from Dakota, but it was so radioactive when it came out that they couldn't use it. So it's been used for all sorts of insanities and terrible things. And what, you know, that thing of that sort of bombs meandering around, you know, that's minor in comparison to some of the things, errors and things that were done on purpose with nuclear materials during the past. So, yes, I mean, I collected a lot of those things for my book, and it's Strange Lovian is, you know, almost putting it too lightly in some cases.
Well, as it happens, Rudolf Herzog, I actually knew Edward Teller quite well and spent quite a bit of time with him. Again, I'm speaking with Rudolf Herzog, the author of Dead Funny, Telling Jokes in Hitler's Germany. His documentary on humor in the Third Reich, Laughing with Hitler, scored top audience ratings in Germany and was also broadcast on the BBC. And other film projects included the hit reality crime series The Heist and The Agent, which investigates the Stasi's top nuclear spy and a double agent for the CIA. He is the son of the celebrated filmmaker Werner Herzog, and his latest book just out is A Short History of Nuclear Folly, Mad Scientists, Dithering Nazis, Lost Nukes, and Catastrophic Cover-Ups. And we're talking about the recent demotion of 17 missileers, as they're called, Air Force officers, with their fingers on the nuclear button, or in this case, two of them in a capsule below the prairies with keys they have to turn simultaneously to launch these weapons. And because the Air Force feels that there is a rot in the morale because these officers recognize that they're babysitting Cold War relics. you, of course, grew up in Germany, and Germany was ground zero for a Cold War between in the Cold War and if NATO and the Warsaw Pact would have gone at it, we would be in big trouble. And I remember once having a conversation with Henry Kissinger, and I pointed out the incredible absurdity of the Cold War, that in effect, NATO's security rested upon Warsaw Pact stability. And as we learn with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that the Warsaw Pact was anything but stable. I mean, they hated the Russians.
Yes, yes. And what you've been talking about, I really do remember that. I mean, I was born in 1973. We were in the crosshairs of that up, you know, until, well, the mid-80s, really. So in Germany. So I remember, for instance, you know, a friend in school had a rich dad, and they were building a nuclear shelter in the garden and stuff like that. So these things happened. My uncle hoarded like sleeping pills in his fridge, which he showed to me once. He said, like, if the rockets come in, I'm going to take those. I mean, that was my sort of youth. It seems bizarre and long ago now, because that, as you say, that all of that has collapsed and gone. But it was very real then. I mean, it was very, very depressing, the feeling in Germany particularly, because we knew we were in the crosshairs. Now, I argue in my book, but also that the crosshairs, they've gone. They've gone to other places, though. And they've gone to places like Asia. They've gone to places possibly like the Middle East, where if there was ever a nuclear arms race there, that would be really, really devastating. I mean, very risky indeed.
Well, so far there is a one-sided nuclear arms race where the Israelis have up to 200 weapons. A lot of them are, in fact, neutron bombs, which they managed to test in secret back in 1979 off the coast of Namibia. So, and of course, Iran is obviously working surreptitiously on getting a nuclear weapon, and Pakistan is the fastest growing arsenal on the planet.
And you also have other countries will start hedging their bets. I mean, if it's like, you know, Saudi Arabia and other countries, they'll be eyeing their neighbors, and they'll want to acquire nuclear weapons, and that could very quickly have a sort of fast forward nuclear proliferation. So we've got to be have our eye on the ball at the moment. It's just it's calm now, and you know, as you say, those guys in those bunkers have nothing to do, and they're depressed. Well, I'm sort of glad that they are, because I mean, it's a lot worse if you're like those rockets are pointing at you and they've got the finger on the trigger, as was the case in the Cold War. And, you know, we in Germany knew that there were some guys in Russia kind of with that finger on the trigger to blow up Munich or Berlin or whatever. So anyway.
Well, yes. But, you know, the extraordinary thing is that we don't know a lot about the nuclear near misses in Russia, but we know as the Soviet Union collapsed that the whole place was a kind of Potemkin village. And the assumption would have to be that we were incredibly lucky. If we were incompetent, they were 10,000 times more incompetent. We do know of a couple of incidents. A missile commander in Russia, his name was Petrov, at one point stopped the launch of a huge number of Soviet ICBMs at the United States based upon a misreading from a satellite that misread the reflections off, light off a cloud to be an incoming, a couple of or two or three incoming Minuteman missiles. And the reason that he didn't press the button, as he was supposed to do, was that he thought if the Americans were going to launch a first strike, they'd fire hundreds of these things, not a few. And then he got, of course, got demoted for not pressing the button.
Yeah, oh God, yes. And there was a similar incident with a flock of geese, where the radar picked up a flock of geese and they thought it was like an incoming ICBM. But what's also awful is, you know, the amount of nuclear weapons that were in fact detonated. I mean, I've got a whole chapter in my book on Soviet nuclear tests, and the problem with that is they basically detonated a bit south of 500 nuclear weapons in Kazakhstan during the Cold War. And the problem is that if you detonate one of those bombs, only part of that fissile material that actually does nuclear fission actually reacts. So the rest is just scattered. So now you've got the problem, as was found out after the WikiLeaks scandal, that the United States is helping to patrol a vast area in Kazakhstan with drones and with all sorts of, you know, manpower on the ground to see that no one just picks up the plutonium or uranium that's scattered wildly over the steppe in Kazakhstan. So we've got a whole legacy of the Cold War that's really kind of daunting, and where we've got vast areas that are polluted.
Right. Well, that's the whole trick of firing a nuclear weapon, is to burn all the fissile material. And in the early days of testing, of course, they weren't that effective, and they only burned up a portion of the fissile material. And the British tested their first nuclear weapons in the Australian outback in the middle of nowhere. And that's contaminated an area the size of Cornwall, and it killed a whole bunch of Aboriginals who, of course, you know, are traditional hunter-gatherers.
Yeah, one must imagine that they had only a single person who was responsible for clearing the area before they detonated a bomb. So there was only one person who would look. As you say, an area the size of Cornwall. And then these are nomadic or semi-nomadic people moving around without any means of communication in that vast area. I mean, that's just not possible. You can't possibly do that. And as you say, you know, some people got into the plume and died of radiation poisoning. And there was a huge inquiry into it in the 1980s. And there are still people suing, or up until recently, trying to sue the Ministry of Defense to claim damages. So this is ongoing. It was actually overturned. They lost the case only last year. But this is still ongoing. We're talking of tests that were done decades ago, but the people are still here. The Cold War may be over, but the people are still here. who suffered all these things. And that's part of the legacy.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking further with Rudolf Herzog about the dark comedy of the nuclear age, prompted by recent revelations that Air Force personnel in charge of launching nuclear missiles have been relieved from their posts.
Walk through the empty streets. There's something constant under my feet. But all the news reports recommended I stay indoors. Because the air outside will make a soul's divided and alarming rate. De la Chelle, simply cannibal, all our insides in.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and I'm continuing the conversation with Rudolf Herzog, the son of the celebrated filmmaker Werner Herzog, and he is the author of the new book just out, A Short History of Nuclear Folly, Mad Scientists, Dithering Nazis, Lost Nukes, and Catastrophic Cover-Ups. Of course, one of the worst cover-ups, and I guess you would have been about 10 years old when it happened, and Germany would have been ground zero, was when Able Archer 83, which was an annual NATO exercise, and NATO, of course, reserved the right to launch nuclear weapons first because of the belief that this Warsaw Pact had greater conventional forces in numbers of tanks and men, etc. And we, as we mentioned earlier, that was, you know, largely a Potemkin village fiction, but the Able Archer 83 was an enhanced exercise where all the leaders of the NATO countries were shipped off to their nuclear bunkers. And 2 years prior to that, the KGB and the GRU had gotten together for the first time, that those two Soviet intelligence agencies had ever cooperated. And they were looking for evidence that the West was about to strike. And then they would preempt that preemption. In other words, they'd beat the West to the nuclear trigger. So you literally had a situation where these two nuclear gunfighters were standing off, the difference being that in the West, nobody knew that the Russians were that paranoid, except for a double agent, a Soviet spy called Gordievsky, who was telling the West that they were digging their own grave. And I've talked to Bud McFarlane and others in the White House at the time, and we came really close, much closer to a nuclear war back in November of 83 than happened during the Cuba crisis even.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Able Archer really freaked the Soviets out. That got them very scared. It's also, you have to see the zeitgeist and the rhetoric that was coming out of these countries as well. I mean, I'm not excluding the United States. I mean, in Reagan America, I mean, it was very bellicose sometimes, the rhetoric. And when they were doing this exercise, that scared the Soviets big time. And if you look back at the Cold War, it started with such an optimism, you know, that especially in America, you know, that nuclear power would, you know, you would have an energy source that could never expire, this huge energy source, and that nuclear weapons would give them leadership over the world forever, that kind of thing. And you know, basically the tide turned. But some of the strangest things that happened during the Cold War, you mentioned Edward Teller before, and the enthusiasm the man had for these weapons. I mean, he wanted to basically create a second Panama Canal with 200 H-bombs and similar projects. I mean, these were serious projects they were considering.
Some of them were actually
executed, not that one, luckily, but it's amazing to see us getting so close to annihilation. And yet there was this sense of incredible optimism at the beginning.
Right. Well, did you know, Rudolf Herzog, that the Panama, the country of Panama, gets all of its drinking water from the canal, from the lakes? That most of the canal are lakes. They're man-made lakes that are fed by water from the rainforests. And if you would have blown up the canal to widen it, you would have had the most radiated water on the planet. What were they thinking?
I'm sure they did, but the Soviets did stuff like that. I mean, not on that scale, but they in Kazakhstan, they created a nuclear lake. I mean, they created a water reservoir using an H-bomb. And there's even footage, you can see it on YouTube, of someone swimming in it, in that water. I don't know how long this man survived, but yes, I mean, to even imagine such things. I think the idea was, or the hope was, that they could reduce the amount of radiation which comes out of the bomb when it explodes, but they never managed to solve that problem. And then they just, because they thought the plans were so great, they did them anyway, or some of them. Some of them were stopped. Teller wanted, for instance, blast a huge harbor in northern Alaska with four H-bombs, sort of saying that that area was uninhabited, which it wasn't. There were some Native American, I think Inuit tribesmen living there, and they still live there. There's a community there. And these people actually in the 60s managed to stop him. They stirred up a huge fuss, a media campaign, and they managed to stop this before, this is long before there was any kind of environmental movement in the United States. And some people very, very, in a very remote community managed to stop this crazy project. But there were many around and some of them were actually done. I mean, they shot up reactors with satellites. And then they came hurtling down again, polluting areas, you know. All these things were tried, and there wasn't really any limit. I mean, short of an all-out nuclear war, a lot of things were actually done during that time.
Well, indeed, and the legacy is out there in terms of pollution, and plutonium has a half-life of 24,500 years. Yeah. That means if you have a pound of plutonium in 24,500 years later, you'll have a half a pound. And it only takes one microscopic speck of it to kill you. So, of course, going back to the beginning of the nuclear age, and as it happens, the nuclear weapon did begin in Germany under Heisenberg and von Weizsäcker, and they actually had the first nuclear reactor. But they dithered around, and the Wehrmacht eventually took all their uranium away to make anti-tank shells. But Heisenberg did go to Denmark to speak with his mentor, Niels Bohr. And, of course, Niels Bohr famously, you know, pointed out the folly of nuclear weapons from the beginning, that the discovery of nuclear fission is not about an unreleased nuclear fission. It's about controlling the release, which has always been the trick, you know, and that's the basis of nuclear power. It's a control release of nuclear fission. And, of course, they made a play about what happened there. But it is a paradox, isn't it, that the whole nuclear bomb was predicated on a false perception that the Nazis were building the bomb. And
yes, well, in reality, they were actually building a reactor.
Right, exactly.
There wasn't anything resembling a workable bomb when the Allies and the Russians entered Germany. So but who's to make that call at the time? Of course, that's sort of hindsight, isn't it?
Sure, it is hindsight. But I bring the point up because that dynamic of basing your nuclear weaponry on the perception of the other side has become the dynamic during the Cold War. And throughout the Cold War, the U.S. was always way ahead of the Russians, but the American people were told about the bomber gap, the missile gap, And then the huge buildup under Reagan was all based upon, I mean, it's basically all driven by the military-industrial complex, because deterrence was a racket. There was no such thing as enough deterrence. So, you know, you could just keep building nuclear weapons and nuclear platforms until the cows come home. And the more you built, the less secure you were. That was the ultimate irony.
Yes, the strategy was called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. That's actually, the acronym is MAD. Actually, as a sort of deterrent, as you say, and you've got to build it up more and more and more. The problem with that also, the more you build and the more that you kind of go into this, the more you're kind of risking that it proliferates, that other countries will follow that example. And if you're talking about those Nazi scientists, actually some of them were captured after the war by the Soviets, and they got them to build a uranium centrifuge. Because in natural uranium, only a very, very small part of that can actually do nuclear fission, so it can be used for a bomb. And to extract that from natural uranium is extremely difficult. And you need basically a cylinder which rotates at several times the speed of sound, so supersonic, and that'll break any metal and whatever. So it's really a sort of miracle machine. And these Nazi scientists or ex-Nazi scientists who were then POWs in the Soviet Union, they actually managed to pull that off. And they peddle off that secret of that centrifuge to various companies or, you know, the Americans after they were released. And then it got out from there to Pakistan, you know, nuclear spy who took the secret. And it allows many states now to sort of build the poor man's bomb. So that's another part of that legacy. It's this sort of Pandora's box is open. And I argue that in my book. And, you know, who knows who has to write the next volume of that book, the one I wrote, because it's, as I say, it's not over. We're going to have to live with that legacy, and it may yet become messy. So I fear that, and we've got to do something about that now.
Well, you know, we started out talking about how the people nursing the U.S. missiles that are still out there, these Cold War relics, are still ready to go, ready to be fired. And the morale is poor because the reality is the guys inside the silos know more about the reality than the officers who are stripping them of their ability to launch missiles because they don't think their morale is good enough. So that was the original paradox of the conversation. So in many ways, it would seem to me that we're in the worst of both worlds. We've had psychological disarmament with the Russians, but we haven't had physical disarmament.
Yes, I would say that's correct. Of course, in terms of numbers, yes, there's a reduction. But in terms of proliferation, actually, the technology, the secret of all of that, the technology getting out to other countries, I'm not sure if we're at the end of that now. That's what I'm concerned about. So, yes, we've got to keep our eye on the ball, and I think nuclear disarmament is still a big priority, because if we don't set an example, who will? And you know, if other countries see that as part of their prestige and as part of their national security, their defense, you know, they'll be trying to acquire these weapons as well, and there'll be no end to it. So I think that's really important.
Just in closing, Rudolf Herzog, it's pretty clear what the message you want to get across is. But I think it's worth noting that the way that you have presented the message is actually very funny. I mean, the book is quite sardonic. It's been described as a cross between Dr. Strangelove and the Atomic Cafe. So just tell us how you approach this subject, and I guess it's, what is it, putting sugar on the bitter pill, as they say?
Well, I don't know. I'm sort of just being descriptive, but I mean, it's just odd to have such a, you know, mass these stories together and then kind of see what people did sometimes with very good intent. Like, for instance, when pacemakers were first made, they didn't have very good batteries, and that was a big problem. So someone had the idea to put in plutonium, a plutonium battery, which will last you more than a lifetime. And that, as such, was a very well-meant idea. And plutonium is actually, if that's in a housing, if that's encased in sealed in metal, that won't hurt the person who's carrying it, because the radiation is of such nature that it, you know, it doesn't come out. It doesn't penetrate that housing. But they never thought of what would happen when the person dies. So all these people in the United States, well, they've got medical records, so that those could be decommissioned. But what about the Soviet Union, where a lot of these pacemakers were transplanted? And you know, there are these people around who've just got plutonium in their chest, and when they die, that'll come out. So a lot of the times, you know, the intent was good, but to us today, it just seems bizarre. I guess that's what you're referring to as humor.
Well,
it is kind of funny, but it's also scary.
Black humor, it's also, I mean, the point is that the humor itself and the irony comes out of the fact that you've done this meticulous research.
Well, thank you. Yes, I did a lot of research, but some of it I experienced myself. You know, after Chernobyl happened, that radioactive cloud came to Germany and rained down there. I remember the school primary going around with a Geiger counter, and we weren't allowed to sit down in the schoolyard. I mean, all of these things were part of my youth. It's bizarre, and it's maybe even in a way you can sort of laugh about it now, but it was very real and very scary back then. So, yes, I think the message is you kind of laugh against your better judgment. But if you really think along the whole thing to the end, of course, it's also very scary, is that humans will not stop at anything when they've got a new technology that's promising. They'll just do almost anything with it. And I hope that'll teach us a lesson if we ever discover another potent technology like nuclear, that will be a little bit more careful and not just quite as crazy with it. As we were with nuclear technology. So I really hope that, and I may be naive to believe that one can still learn from history, but I do. So, and that's why I wrote the book. So,
well,
I hope for the best.
We're grateful that you wrote the book, Rudolf Herzog, and we thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Rudolf Herzog, who's the author of Dead Funny, Telling Jokes in Hitler's Germany. His documentary on humor in the Third Reich, Laughing with Hitler, scored top audience ratings in Germany and was also broadcast on the BBC. And his other film projects include the hit reality crime series The Heist and The Agent, which investigates the Stasi's top nuclear spy and a double agent for the CIA. He is the son of the celebrated filmmaker Werner Herzog, and his latest book just out is A Short History of Nuclear Folly: Mad Scientists, Dithering Nazis, Lost Nukes, and Catastrophic Cover-Ups. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.